to lecture number 4 for our motor system series. And in this lecture, we're going to be looking at motor innovation and the motor unit. But before we get into this lecture, I just want to make an announcement. For lecture 87, in which we're going to be looking at the movement disorders of the basal ganglia, there is a link that would be useful for you to look at before you come to that lecture. And I've placed that link in your additional resources in week 15. So when you go into additional resources for this week, you'll see a folder named Movement Disorder Videos. That would be useful for you to look at before you come to the movement disorder lectures on the basal ganglia. All right, so you guys had a good weekend, I guess? Your faces look bright and ready to go. So let's do that. Let's go. So we have 8 objectives for this lecture on the innovation of the muscles and the motor unit. And we're going to go through each of them. So we begin by looking at objective number 1, which requires us to explain the classification of neuronal fibers and relations among conduction velocity, axonal diameter, and myelination. But before we do that, of course, you have to answer your question. Which of the following fibers is sensitive to muscle tension? This is a relatively simple question if you review the slides before coming to lecture. All right, so the larger percentage of you chose the correct answer, which would be the 1B fibers. And I see a lot of you would have chosen the 1A fibers. As we go through the lecture, we will understand what's the role of the 1B fiber and the 1A fiber. Classification of sensory fibers in muscles. So we can see in this table that it is divided into an upper part that's labeled in blue and the lower part that is labeled in black. For our discussion this morning as it relates to the innervation of the muscles, we're going to be looking at the fibers that are colored blue. The ones on the lower aspect of the table, they're going to be looking at pressure, pain, and chemical senses, but we're looking at movement of the muscle, all right? So we're not going to be focusing on the fiber types in the bottom of the table for this lecture. We're going to be focusing on the fiber types on the top, which would be your 1A fiber, your 1B fiber, and your type 2 fiber. We can see that all three of these fibers, they're large, and they're myelinated. So what does that mean? I heard someone over there say. Right, so you have fast conduction. Now your 1A fibers, a significant amount of you chose 1A fibers for the question before that asked about muscle tension. They are responsible for sensing the length and the rate of change of stretch or the velocity of stretch of the muscles. This would be the role of your 1A fibers. Your 1A fibers has no role in measuring or assessing tension of the muscle. It just assesses how much the muscle has been stretched and how fast that stretch is occurring. Your 1B fiber is going to be responsible for assessing tension within the muscle. What is the load that has been applied to this muscle that is causing the particular stretch? And that's your 1B fibers. Now your 1B fibers are associated with your Golgi tendon organ that we're going to be looking at this morning. Your 1B fibers for your Golgi tendon organ, while your 1A fibers are for your primary spindle endings. And we're going to see a diagram in a minute that will basically illustrate what I just described. Then there's your type 2 fibers. These are called, these are associated with a secondary spindle ending, and they are also responsible for assessing length. So as it relates to assessing length, we have our 1A and our 1B fiber, our 1A and our type 2, sorry, fibers that assess length. But in addition to assessing length, your 1A fiber also assesses the rates of change of length, or how fast that change in length is occurring. So the muscle spindle, important to note, your muscle spindle, even though it has a name muscle, it's a sensory organ. And it's responsible, as we saw earlier in the type, in relation to the types of fibers that are associated with the spindle, it's responsible for assessing length, the change in length of the muscle, and also the tension that's applied to the muscles. Apart from having the sensory innervations that we just talked about, the type 1A, 1B, and type 2 fibers, there's also motor innervation to the muscle spindle. And what is the motor innervation to the muscle spindle? We talked about it in the last lecture. Yeah, what is the motor innervation? What motor fibers? Right, your gamma motor neurons would be associated with your muscle spindle, as we looked at in the last lecture. Now, these sensory fibers that we look at, they help in the mediation of the myotactic, or what we call the deep tendon reflexes. So like when you do your Babinski reflex, not a Babinski, sorry, your biceps reflex, or when you do your patella tendon reflex, or your triceps reflex, you are actually eliciting the deep tendon reflex, which depends heavily on the muscle spindle. So if your muscle spindle is damaged, you will have a defective reflex in terms of your deep tendon reflexes. We talked about the gamma motor neuron already being responsible for mediating the activity of the fibers in the muscle spindle. Now, muscles involved in fine movements, such as your hand, your extraocular muscles, these have large amounts of muscle spindle. While muscles of the trunk that are not responsible for such fine movements, these have sparse numbers of muscle spindles. And this is a diagram that illustrates what our muscle spindle looks like. Now, the gray aspect on the outside, that would be the capsule of the muscle spindle. And if we were to put the extrafusal fibers, or your actively contracting skeletal muscle fibers, into this picture, they would be on the outside of the capsule. But they're not here right now, so just try to imagine it. So deep within the muscle, you have these capsules that have different intrafusal fibers within them. And we see these fibers depicted here. There's three in number. We have our dynamic nuclear back fiber, and we see it's represented in this pink color. Then we have the nuclear chain fiber, that's slender, all the way down. So this is the one in the center. And then we have our static nuclear back fiber. You would notice that the nuclear back fibers and the nuclear chain fibers, they have different shapes. The reason for this is that for the nuclear back fibers, they have a large collection of nuclei in this part that is bulged. So the bulging part, the reason for that is because they have a large collection of nuclei in that region. For your nuclear chain fibers, the nuclei are arranged in a chain-like fashion, so you don't see that bulging appearance as you see with the nuclear back fibers. Now, apart from these three intrafusal fibers, we also see that we have the innervation via the gamma motor neuron. Now, if you note well, your gamma motor neuron would be innervating the ends, the polar ends of these intrafusal fibers, because these are actually the ends that can contract. The central aspects of the intrafusal fibers, that's your nuclear bag and your nuclear chain fibers, they are not contractile. However, when the ends contract, the stretch that occurs within the fibers would be sensed by your sensory fibers that are associated with a central aspect of your nuclear bag and nuclear chain fibers. So if you notice, you have your 1A fiber wrapped around the belly, if you want to call it, of your bag fibers, and it also is wrapped around the central portion of your nuclear chain fibers. And we said our 1A fiber is responsible for assessing the length and the velocity with which length changes within the muscle. And we see it's associated with all three of these intrafusal muscle fibers. For the type 2 fiber, which is only responsible for assessing length, we see that it's associated with the nuclear chain fiber and the static nuclear bag fiber. Now, let's talk about the static nuclear bag fiber and the dynamic nuclear bag fiber. When you hear the terms static and dynamic, what comes to mind? When you think about static, you're thinking about what? Stationary and dynamic, moving, very well. So your static nuclear bag fiber is going to convey information to your central nervous system via your 1A fiber about what's happening with the muscle during activity, all right? So as soon as, for example, as soon as I extend, my 1A fiber is going to be able to detect what's happening with my muscle, and that information is going to be coming from my static nuclear bag fiber, and you also have some of that being fed into your 1A fiber via the nuclear chain fiber. Sorry, I said the wrong thing. Let me just go back again. So the static nuclear bag fiber is responsible for when you're not moving, all right? So I'm correcting myself. So when there's no movement, while the dynamic, that's going to be giving information for when there is movement. Now that is the reason why we see our type 2 fiber is not associated with your dynamic nuclear bag fiber, okay? So your type 2 fiber is just going to give information in terms of proprioception, where your joints are in time and space when it is not moving. And so for that reason, it's not associated with your dynamic nuclear bag fiber, because your dynamic nuclear bag fiber is going to give information about movement. Is that clear? Yes? Okay. So therefore, because our type 2 fiber is associated with our nuclear chain fiber and our static nuclear bag fiber, we can infer that these two intrafusal fibers would inform the central nervous system about length of the muscle in a static situation or when there is no movement. All right? While your dynamic nuclear bag fiber is only going to be involved when there is movement. So we see here the secondary sensory endings are associated with your type 2 fibers, and the primary sensory endings are associated with your 1A fibers. And your 1A fibers, these are the ones that are most responsive, and that would make sense. If they're going to be talking about telling the nervous system about what is happening in terms of the velocity in which the muscle is changing, they have to be very reactive. While the type 2 fibers are secondary fibers, they're not as reactive, and so they talk about stationary position. Describe the physiological role of the muscle spindle. So why do we need a muscle spindle? What does it do? How does it help us as it relates to motor function? So as we said earlier, your muscle spindle is a sensory organ. It informs your central nervous system of what is going on with your muscles as it relates to stretch, the rate at which stretch is occurring, and the tension that is applied to the muscle. And we did identify the myotactic reflexes, or the deep tendon reflexes, being closely associated with our muscle spindle, and we're going to see how that is so shortly. It also provides proprioceptive information to our central nervous system, that is, where our muscles and our joints as it relates to time and space. And it helps in the regulation of muscle contraction under the influences of descending motor pathways and afferent fibers. So your afferent fibers would be your 1A fiber and your type 2 fibers, while your descending motor fiber is would be your gamma motor neurons, all right? And we saw from the previous lecture that your gamma motor neurons are influenced by some of the upper motor neurons when we studied other motor pathways. Do we remember that? Yes? So when we studied the other motor pathways, we saw that most of those pathways had influence on both alpha and gamma motor neurons, while some only had influence on gamma motor neurons only. Do you recall that? Very well. So these pathways are going to help to control the muscle spindle, and that helps in the control of contraction and even the tone of muscles. So let's look at the myotactic reflex and how the muscle spindle is associated with it. So here in this diagram, we have a patella hammer. Here we see the patella. This is the patella tendon. So when you're doing the patella reflex, what you want to do is to strike the patella tendon with the hammer. Of course, this is the lower limb. This would be your femur. Here we have your quadriceps, which are associated with the patella tendon reflex. And here on the opposite side of that, or to the back of the leg, we have our extensor muscles. This is a cross-section of the spinal cord, which would be our controller mediation center for the myotactic reflex. So we strike the patella tendon. When the patella tendon is struck by the hammer, there will be stretch. Okay, the stretch may not be significant to you, but it's significant enough to elicit a response. Now, what is that response? That stretch is going to be detected by the muscle spindle. And we will have our 1A fibers going to inform the central nervous system, that is, here we're talking about our spinal cord, that there has been a stretch to the patella tendon. Now we see that nerve is going to go through the dorsal column because it's a sensory nerve in nature, and it's going to synapse on a motor neuron in the ventral horn. What motor neuron is it going to synapse on? It's going to the extrafusal muscle fibers. So this motor neuron has to be an... Right, so this motor neuron here is an alpha motor neuron. Okay, so we had stretch of the tendon that is detected by the muscle spindle, or 1A fibers goes to the central nervous system at that level of the spinal cord. And when we study spinal reflexes, we will see what level of the spinal cord is associated with the knee jerk or the patella tendon reflex. And that 1A fiber now is going to synapse onto our alpha motor neuron, which is associated with the stretched muscle. Now, this would be our quadriceps muscle. Now, also, you would note that the alpha motor neuron also synapses via an interneuron onto the alpha motor neuron that is associated with the antagonistic muscle. Okay? So we have two alpha motor neurons involved here. We have one that is associated with the muscle that has been stretched, and we have one that is associated with the antagonistic muscle, and this interaction is via an interneuron. What do we get? We get extension. This is the classical response that you should see in someone whose patella tendon reflex is working effectively. Now, how does that extension take place? Now, that extension takes place because our quadriceps muscle is now going to contract via stimulation of the alpha motor neuron, and your extensor muscles on the back of the leg, they are going to relax because of the inhibitory interaction via the interneuron with the alpha motor neuron. So for the leg to be extended, of course, you know that the anterior muscles must contract, and the ones in the posterior or the antagonistic muscles must relax. And so this is how the muscle spindle is associated with a myotactic or deep tendon reflex. Is that clear? Okay. So now that we've talked about the muscle spindle and the deep tendon reflex, now let's look at the Golgi tendon organ and the physiological role of this organ. Now first, where is the Golgi tendon organ located? Unlike the muscle spindle as found within the belly of the muscle, your Golgi tendon organ is going to be towards the ends of the muscle. So we know that the muscle terminates into a tendon that then connects to the bone of whichever particular body area. So your Golgi tendon is going to be found at that junction just between the muscles and the tendons. And unlike the muscle spindle that's associated in parallel with the muscle fibers, your Golgi tendon organ is associated in series, okay? So it's associated in series with the muscle fibers. And that position helps them to be able to effectively assess the tension that is being applied to a particular muscle. And this assessment of tension will help in the modulation of our contractive force. So this is a diagram that actually illustrates the location of our Golgi tendon organ. So here we have an extrafusal fiber that we would have removed from the belly of this. Here we have, an intrafusal muscle fiber that we would have removed from the belly of this particular muscle. So let's say that this is the biceps muscle. Just for illustration purposes, we removed the extrafusal fiber so that you can see its arrangement. We see the 1A fibers associated with it. We know that it would be innervated by gamma motor neurons. Then we see your alpha motor neuron that would be associated with the extrafusal muscle fiber here. And towards the end of those of that extrafusal muscle fiber, we have our Golgi tendon organ. And for the Golgi tendon organ, our sensory afferent would be our 1B fiber, which we saw earlier based on the question is responsible for assessing tension within the muscle. So why do we need to know about tension that's being applied to the muscle? Now let's see. I decide that I want to be adventurous and I want to test my power. So I decide that I'm going to enter a weightlifting competition. Yes? And I'm very ambitious, so I'm going to start with 200 pounds. So I turn up at the competition, and I'm ready to compete fiercely, all right? I don't mind that everybody else seems really buff. You know, I can do this. So I see the 200-pound weight, and I hold it. And I pull as hard as I can. What's going to happen? So let's just see by chance. I'm able to lift that weight 2 centimeters from the ground. What is going to be happening to my muscle? It's being stretched extensively, too much. And if I don't have a protective mechanism built into my muscles, well, then I'm going to tear my muscle from my bone. We don't want to do that. So This is where your Golgi tendon organ comes in. See, my Golgi tendon organ is going to say, you know what, Dr. McKenzie? Yes, it's good that you're ambitious, but just leave this thing alone. All right? So even though I'm saying consciously, I am going to pick this up, my Golgi tendon organ senses that the tension is too much. And so it sends information to the central nervous system, that is, whatever specific level of the spinal cord, that's going to be my cervical level of the spinal cord, via my 1B fiber. And it enters via the dorsal horn and its synapses via an inhibitory interneuron onto the alpha motor neurons associated with that extrafusal or with those extrafusal fibers. So even though my mind is into it, my Golgi tendon organ is saying no. And that synapsing via the inhibitory interneuron is going to cause my alpha motor neurons to cause my extrafusal fibers to relax. So there is going to be no more contraction. And what is going to happen to the weight? It's going to fall to the ground. Falls to the ground because I can't hold it anymore. Even though my mind is saying I can hold this, my Golgi tendon organ is saying, no, this is too much for you. Let's save this for another day. Okay? So that is how your Golgi tendon organ is able to sense tension and protect you if the tension is too much. But let's say that the tension was not too much, okay? So I'm there and I didn't get through it with that 200. So I'm going to choose something that's a little less challenging, something that's suitable for me. So someone comes and they say to me, hold this, and I put my hands out. And I'm like, okay, this looks like something that I can, can do some building with. And they put it into my hands, but it's actually heavier than I thought. What's going to happen to my hands? It drops. Yes? Why does it drop? Golgi tendon organ again. All right, so the Golgi tendon organ recognizes that the tension is too much. So it tells my alpha motor neurons, relax, okay? Now in this instance, the tension may not be sufficient to make me drop it to the ground, but maybe I will just adjust how I'm holding the weight. Do you understand? Yes? So it's not in every instance that you stop the activity altogether, but it actually can cause you to adjust how your muscles are situated or adjust the contractive force of the muscles so that you are protected. And that's what this whole diagram here is talking about. So let's go through it. It says, one, high tension in the muscle vigorously activates our 1B fiber, as we talked about, me trying to lift that 200 pounds. The 1B afferents activate interneurons, that's what's located here, that inhibit alpha motor neurons communicating with overactive extrafusal fibers. And aren't you happy that we have this protection? I am certainly happy about that. Then there's reduced activity in the alpha motor neurons, which relaxes the overactive muscles. And if it's too heavy, I'm going to drop it to the ground. If it's not too heavy, I'm just going to basically adopt a new position that's appropriate for my ability. And that's what 4 is saying. At lower muscle tension, the apparatus exerts excitatory influences that aid in rhythmic muscle contractions. Okay, your dynamic nuclear back fiber. So this is the one I made the mistake on earlier. Yes, but I did correct myself, and for clarity purposes, I'll just say it over again. Your dynamic nuclear back fibers would be those that are associated with movement, activity. Okay? So which of these sensory fibers, important, would be associated with your dynamic nuclear back fiber? We have alpha and gamma, all right? So do we have alpha and gamma fibers associated with our dynamic nuclear back fiber? What about alpha? No, alpha is for your extrafusal fibers. Gamma, are they associated with your dynamic nuclear back fibers? Yes, they are, but they're not sensory in nature, all right? So those two would be incorrect. Type 3 fibers, as we saw, those are associated with sensing pain and so on, and those are now going to be associated with our nuclear back fibers. Type 4, the same as type 3. And so we're left with 1A, 1B, and 2. We just talked about 1B being associated with the, what do you want? The Golgi tendon organ, which assesses tension. So 1B would be incorrect. So we're left with 5 and 7, which are our 1A and our type 2, our primary and sensory fibers. Our primary and secondary, sensory fibers. So which one of these would be associated with the dynamic nuclear back fibers that, and we said the dynamic nuclear back fibers is talking about movement or activity. Let's see what you guys thought. Right, 68% of you thought it was our 1A fiber, and that is correct. Our type 2 fibers would be associated with the static nuclear bag and the nuclear chain fiber. And again, this is just to review what we would have talked about earlier. So you have here your dynamic in pink, your nuclear chain in green, and blue we have the static nuclear back fiber. And we see that our type, or 1A fiber, or our primary sensory fibers, is associated with all three of these intrafusal fibers, while our type 2 fiber is associated only with the static and the nuclear chain fiber. On the gamma motor neurons, as we said, they're located towards the end or the contracting aspects of the intrafusal fibers. Describe the general features of the motor control system. And we've seen this diagram before, and we're going to see it until we get to the end of the motor series. Now, we already went through what happens at the cortical level. We talked about what's going to happen with our corticospinal and our other motor pathways, which would be our upper motor neurons. These are going to communicate with the brainstem and the spinal cord, as we discussed in previous lectures. And what we're talking about now is basically the lower motor neurons. So we're looking at the gamma loop, we're looking at intrafusal fibers. So what we're discussing here is what's happening with the lower motor neurons and what's happening with the muscle fibers. So by the end of this lecture, we should be able to appreciate how our gamma motor neurons, alpha motor neurons, how they're interacting with the muscle and the muscle spindle, and how that modulates our contractive abilities, or the abilities for the muscles to contract. Define the motor units and know the types of motor fibers within the muscle. Now, this is a very important concept, the motor unit. What is the motor unit? So the motor unit is a combination of your alpha motor neurons and all the extrafusal fibers that it innervates. So the alpha motor neurons and all the extrafusal fibers that it innervates. With this definition, we see that the muscle spindle is not a part of the motor unit. Okay, it's just the extrafusal fibers and alpha motor neuron. There's no gamma motor neuron there. There are no sensory fibers there. It's just alpha motor neurons and extrafusal fibers. Now, your motor unit can accomplish fine control, or it can accomplish coarse control. Now, what determines that is the amount of extrafusal fibers that is supplied by one alpha motor neuron. For finely controlled movements, such as our extraocular muscles and our hands, we will have a small amount of extrafusal fibers being supplied by one alpha motor neuron. So for example, 10 extrafusal fibers being supplied by one alpha motor neuron in the hand or extraocular muscles, while for like the trunk and other muscles that we use for posture, that we don't need such fine control, we see that we will have about 1,000 extrafusal fibers being supplied by one alpha motor neuron. So far, we see that for fine control, we need a small amount of extrafusal fibers associated with one alpha motor neuron, and we need many muscle spindles associated with that muscle. And that was what we would have discussed thus far in this lecture as it relates to fine motor control. Now, your types of motor units, and I'm sure you will have seen this information before. So you have three types. So you have type 1 and type 2, which is classified into A and B. So your type 1 fibers would be your slow twitch fibers, and I'm sure you would know that these fibers are associated with large amounts of mitochondria, so they look very red in color. They are associated with low tension and they're fatigue resistant. So that means it takes a long time for them to get tired. Okay, so these muscles are useful in maintaining posture. Okay, because I'm going to be standing here for 2 hours, and so I need my slow twitch fibers. Okay, so they're associated with maintaining posture and aerobic activities. They're aerobic in nature, meaning that they require oxygen, and that makes sense because you're talking about the presence of mitochondria. Now, these type 1 fibers are innervated by relatively small motor neurons and axons. So relatively small motor neurons are associated with these type 1 or slow twitch fibers. Now we move on to your type 2 fibers, which can be classified into type 2A or type 2B. Your type 2A fiber is a fast twitch fiber, and it's relatively fatigue resistant. So for these types of fibers, you don't have so much mitochondria associated with it. And the type 1A, you can accommodate some aerobic capacity. And these fibers are innervated by relatively large motor neurons. The type 2B fibers, they are similar also in terms of their innervation by relatively large motor neurons. But these are the ones that you would call into play for anaerobic activity. So if I decide to do a 100-meter sprint, if I decide to give up weightlifting and go into sprinting, I would need my type 2B fibers. And so these are the different types of motor units, and we see the relationship with the alpha motor neurons that is associated with them. Finally, describe the mechanisms where contraction of muscle can be increased. So what can cause contraction of muscles to increase? It can either be because you're having increase in the firing rates, all right, so you're stimulating that muscle more intensely, or you're recruiting larger amounts of motor units, and that is going to increase your contractive, or your ability for the muscle to contract. So let's look at the clinical correlation. We'll talk about lower motor neuron syndrome, which I'm sure you know very, very well at this point. Is that so? Is that true? You're getting there. That's okay. All right, so your lower motor neuron syndrome, as you know, it's associated with damage to the lower motor neuron. And it can be from the level of the ventral horn and then anywhere along that lower motor neuron. And we know the motor neurons, they're going to be arising from the basal plates. And they're the ones, of course, that communicate directly with our skeletal muscles. The features that we would have discussed before extensively would be paresis or paralysis. What's the difference between these two terms, paresis and paralysis? I'm hearing partial. Which one is partial? Paresis, right. So paresis is partial loss of the muscle activity, while paralysis, you cannot use the muscle at all. Then there's hyporeflexia. Now you can have hyporeflexia or areflexia, depending on the extent of the injury to that lower motor neuron. And since I'm on this, I received quite a few emails from students who are asking me about a few questions that they encountered during the weekend from the quiz, the weekly quiz, and they were asking about areflexia or hyporeflexia in an upper motor neuron disease, okay? So there was a question about someone who had an injury at, I think it was somewhere in the thoracic level of the cord, and 2 days after that injury, what will you see? And the answer choice was areflexia of the lower limb, and so they were asking me, why is it that we would see areflexia of the lower limb? Why do we see areflexia of the lower limb when we have an upper motor neuron injury 2 days after that injury. Right, so spinal shock. So you have to wait until 4 weeks before you can actually see the true picture of the upper motor neuron syndrome. So if they're asking you about 2 days, that means that they want you to be able to identify that this patient is in spinal shock, and therefore at that point you will see a lower motor neuron picture. Is that clear? Good. So we have hyporeflexia. As I said, we can have areflexia. Then there's hypotonia. So you have decreased tone. So even when you're not doing anything, your muscle has some tone to it. But if you've lost the innervation to that muscle, well, then the tone of the muscle will be decreased or lost altogether. Now, how can we assess the tone of the muscle? Anyone has any idea? Okay, so let me have a willing participant. Someone come up. Who is going to come? Come. Okay, we have a volunteer. Let's give him a round of applause as he comes. All right, so I want you to stand here for me. Face me. Now, what I do, I want you to practice on the person that's close to you. All right? Yes. So, to assess the tone of, what's your name?
Samir.
Samir, to assess Samir's tone, let's say, in his upper limbs, I'm going to passively move the upper limbs. So I take Samir's hand, and let's say I want to assess the tone here. All right? So, yeah? Can assess it of his fingers. I don't see anybody doing what I'm doing. Very well. So we have some persons who are actually doing it. Thank you, Samir. Now, you're actually going to practice this in your neuroscience lab, your small group. You're going to have a session where you go through how to assess tone and bulk and so on. But for persons, even when they're relaxed, their muscle has some tone to it, or it has some amount of resistance. And it may be difficult for you to assess what is normal tone versus hypotonia right now. But someone who has lost the innervation to the muscles, you would find that muscle is very lax or loose. As you do those activity, you will not be able to appreciate any form of resistance. So patients who have lower motor neuron diseases can have hypotonia. Fasciculations. What are fasciculations? They're visible twitches in the muscles. Okay, so you can see this in lower motor neuron syndrome. Fibrillations, no, they're actually muscular contractions, small contractions in the muscle that you cannot see with a visible eye. You have to do an electromyography to be able to appreciate fibrillation. So the difference between these two is which one you can see and which one you cannot see. Okay. And then you will have muscular atrophy, or what's called wasting. And for lower motor neuron syndrome, the wasting is usually very profound. You have lots of wasting. Someone who has an upper motor neuron syndrome, you may see some amount of wasting, but it's not very significant. With lower motor neuron syndrome, you have profound or excessive wasting of the muscle. So hypotonia, as we just looked at how we can assess it, it's pathologically reduced level of sustained partial contraction of the extrafusal fibers. And we see how we can assess it, if there's no passive resistance when we go through those activities, well, then we can infer that the patient has hypotonia. Now, important to note, hypotonia is not only seen with lower motor neuron diseases. You can see hypotonia in someone who has a cerebellar lesion. Now, I know we haven't studied the cerebellum as yet, but we're going to get to it, but just underscore the point that someone who has a cerebellar lesion can present with hypotonia. Now, how will you know the difference between a cerebellar lesion presenting with hypotonia and a lower motor neuron syndrome presenting with hypotonia? How would you know the difference? Right, so you look for the other symptoms associated with that particular pathology. So if someone has hypotonia, hyporeflexia, wasting, this person would most likely have a lower motor neuron syndrome. And if someone has a hypotonia associated with cerebellar symptoms, which we'll talk about when we get to that lecture, well, then you can infer that that person most likely has a cerebellar lesion that is causing the hypertonia. Injury to alpha motor neurons will likely result in which of the following signs? Your alpha motor neuron is going to be innervating what type of fibers? What fibers? Your extrafusal muscle fibers are the ones that you can actually see contracting. So we are going to end up with what type of syndrome? An upper motor neuron syndrome or a lower motor neuron syndrome? A lower motor neuron syndrome. So we're tasked with figuring out from this list which of these is associated with lower motor neuron syndrome. So your Babinski is the same as your extensor plantar response. And that is associated with lower motor neuron syndrome or upper motor neuron syndrome? Upper, so that's out. Your clonus, upper again. Hypertonia, that's associated with upper motor neuron syndrome. Spasticity, upper again. And so we're only left with atrophy, and we know that that's associated with lower motor neuron syndromes. Okay, so 79% of you were able to get that correct. I was hoping that more of you, but we're getting there. All right, you may take your break, and we'll return for the next lecture.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.